Anyway, we want to close our time up just with, I think, a little reflection on some of the fruits of the contemplative when, like I said that first night, when they move from practices to disciplines. And I think it's pretty easy to sort of guess what the fruits are. I think if you all just had a quick minute to sort of bend your brain on it, it would be like peacefulness. That's probably a fruit of the contemplative. And some of these other things. But I think some of the more profound fruits, and I think some of the more profound impacts that the prayers have on us are some of the things that we've been hinting at for the past 2 days. And those are things like acceptance. And I think acceptance gets played out in a lot of different ways in our lives, but I think acceptance leads to a proper sense of identity. And I think when we can learn to accept and learn to accept who we are and receive the gift of ourselves, then acceptance moves to unity. And I think these things clearly are wrapped all up in love. And we believe that. We believe that God is love. That's one of the great sort of esoteric metaphors for one of our notions of the divine, that God is love. And I think in the practices, we move into union. We rest in mystery. Sometimes folks get a little nervous when we talk about these practices because they think they've been co-opted from other religions or other faith traditions. And some of us, like Felina talked about yesterday, get a little nervous because we actually want to control our ideas of God. And we actually like to think we are in control, like a puppet master pulling the strings of God with the kinds of prayers that we pray. So that if we pray the right prayer, if we ask it the right way, if we recite it in the right fashion or manner, that God would actually give us what we think we want. And really that pulls that trigger of power and control for some of us. Some of us are a little afraid to sort of give ourselves to solitude, silence, or stillness because actually we don't trust God, right? I was looking out the window of our room the other day and I saw some of these kids doing the ropes course, right? And it's like we all get a little nervous when we try to do the ropes course, when we sort of do that trust fall backwards into the arms of some of our friends. And I think sometimes that's a good analogy to think about. What is the gift of the contemplative? It's actually a trust fall. It's actually not being in control of your prayer, but letting God be God. But y'all, some of us actually don't trust God. And when we approach solitude, silence, and stillness with fear, what that is telling us is that we think God is worse than us. We think God won't catch us. It's actually, we think we can trust people we don't know more than we can trust the God who saves us. And so I hope over the past couple days we've, you know, demystifying mysticism is sort of a bad angle on this, but at least make some of these things a little bit more accessible, maybe a little bit more user-friendly for y'all, and hopefully introduce you to at least some easy sort of on-ramps into the tradition. And what I want to do is sort of wrap our time up together with you with a couple reflections, though, on those fruits of acceptance, identity, and unity. And I'm just going to give you the punchline now. I think that the piece on unity is the most important piece for us as we wrap up a time like this together, because some of you won't be able to do this alone. Some of you won't do this on your own, and you'll quickly discover that you need one another. One of the retreats that we host over here in the Benedictine Monastery is we welcome folks. They, like I said, they come from all over North America, actually even different countries outside the U.S., and share a meal together. We have an opening session where we introduce ourselves and our intention, and then we enter. This is one of our retreats. Don't be afraid of the others. Then we enter 40 hours of silence, and we actually do, ends up probably being about 6 or 7 hours of centering prayer sits, several examines. And then at the end of the retreat, we break the silence over a meal, a brunch, and then we sort of debrief it together. And it's pretty funny, actually, because first of all, you got all these extroverted folks who's just like, they can't stop talking after 40 hours of silence, which is basically almost nothing. But what's also funny is you start to hear these people tell their stories of they only would have gone on a silent retreat if they weren't alone. And it's like, that sounds crazy. but it's like we need each other. Some of us really are going to need each other if we want to nurture some of these practices. And so that's the punchline, and that's how it's going to close. But these reflections, I want to draw these reflections from one of the, for me, what has been, I think, one of the most vibrant communities that we've ever interacted with anywhere in the world. And it is a community of hope, and it is a place of healing. And it has been a sort of envelope of embrace, restoration, and wholeness. And so for several years, one of the projects that we worked on and one of the projects that we actually helped sort of support with a lot of energy was a cooperative of women in Calcutta, India, who'd come out of the commercial sex industry. Right? There's this neighborhood, if you've been to Calcutta, maybe you're familiar with this, called Sonaghachi. And it's essentially it's two blocks long, and they say that there's between 10 and 12,000 women and children who have been trafficked into prostitution there. Maybe some of y'all saw a film a few years ago called Born into Brothels. Anybody remember that? That was actually shot. That was actually filmed in this neighborhood. At the both ends of Sonaghachi are police officers who actually sit there, and they essentially, because I think of some of the consequences, the unfortunate consequences of chronic poverty, sort of protect the interests of the brothel owners and the pimps. And so in India, it's actually legal to prostitute if you're 16 years or older, but it's illegal to traffic persons into the sex trade. However, these police officers don't let the Burmese, the Nepali, the Bangladeshi women out of the neighborhood. There's a union of commercial sex workers that also makes it very, very difficult for anybody who's not actually paying for sex to get into the neighborhood. And so the community that we are a part of, one of the guys that we worked with, actually sort of accidentally met a 16-year-old girl who was on part of the sex industry there, and it shocked him, and it should break all of our hearts, but it devastated him. And so he tried to figure out what he could do, what we could do. And over the course of 8 years, him and some of the other folks that we work with tried to find our way into that neighborhood. We tried to find a way to see if there was something that we could do to help. And for 8 years, we took it on the chin. Folks in our community were threatened, were beaten up, had knives to their throats, were locked in brothel rooms. And I think this is important. I think a lot of us care about fighting human trafficking, but I think a lot of us don't actually realize the costs that are involved. And I tell people, don't get involved unless you realize that this will come back to hurt you. If you have families, traffickers, these folks know where your stress fractures are, where you're sensitive. This isn't sort of just something that we can talk about. This requires, I think, real commitment. There's profound costs involved, and some of the folks that we work with paid those costs dearly. But after 8 years of taking it on the chin, after eight hard years, the Union of Commercial Sex Workers actually let us into the neighborhood. It was crazy. Started to get to know some of the women, and we'd sit on the side of the road and share cups of tea and play with their kids and sort of get to know their stories. And after several years of building trust and forming friendships, sort of ask the women, like, what does freedom look like for you? Because you know in these neighborhoods where folks are forced to sell sex, when their kids are old enough for sex, often they prostitute their own children. And this is also one of the unfortunate consequences of chronic poverty, this sort of sense of hopelessness, that there's really no way out. Not to be dehumanizing, but almost a form of learned helplessness, a resignation. But as we ask the women, what does it look like? What does freedom look like? I mean, really, they put their children first, and it was their hopes for their own kids, that their kids wouldn't have to live the lives that they lived. And so one of the women was like, we want to do something beautiful. We want to do something creative. And so this idea sort of came forward that we would gather up all these used, ratty, tore up, discarded saris, right? The traditional dress worn by many Indian, actually South Asian women. And we would clean these saris up, this beautiful, beautiful, colorful material, and begin to make scarves and bags and purses and big, big, pretty quilts out of this. And it was actually a profound symbol, if you can imagine this, because a lot of these women felt used up. They felt dirty. They felt discarded. So to take something and to not only make it beautiful but valuable was actually a sign, right, of restoration. And so we found lots of traction in this. And we're very fortunate, actually. The women came together and they began to invite other women who worked in their brothels and in their buildings into the co-op and really created, I think, a really beautiful sort of interruption in this neighborhood of wholeness, healing, restoration. So every year, I visit this community there in the city. Every year I sit on the floor, some of these ladies are stitching blankets, and every year I go back and we drink tea together and we catch up. And so a couple years ago I was visiting one of the community centers in the city, and I was looking at one of the blankets a woman had just finished stitching. And as she was holding it up, I noticed that on every single blanket, and we own quite a few of these blankets ourselves, but on every single one of these blankets, these quilts sort of stitched out of old recycled saris, are these little patches, right? Because you can imagine, we're using material that's frayed, that's tore up. And so when somebody finishes a blanket, they have to sort of clean it up. They sort of have to fix the tears, and they have to sort of make it presentable. But when I look at the blankets, the patches for me are the best parts, because the patches make every single one of those blankets unique, every single one of those blankets different. And some of these ladies are super skilled. They'll actually sort of save a bit of the sari cloth that they're stitching their blanket out of so that they can use that cloth for the patches. And they actually sometimes perfectly align the patch with the design on the material. And sometimes other ladies just sort of grab whatever cloth's lying around. If it's a different color completely, they put it on there. And it's like those blankets to me pop, right? It's like these orange, these red patches on these blue blankets. It just looks super cool. So as one of the ladies finished her blanket, she's holding it up. And there was sort of one of the project managers was looking at it. I said to my friend Upendra, I was like, man, I love those patches. That's my favorite part of the blanket. And the lady who had finished the blanket looked at me and sort of just rolled her eyes and shook her head like I'm some sort of punk. And Upendra started laughing. And he was like, brother, he said, the patches are the hardest part. Actually, the patches are the part that the women hate doing the most, because sometimes it takes the women longer to stitch these little tiny patches on these blankets than it does for them to make an entire blanket. And I think about that a lot when we speak about acceptance. It's the patches that make those blankets beautiful, and it's actually the patches that make us beautiful. And this is the invitation. Lots of us have made some pretty terrible mistakes, and we just won't let ourselves off the hook. Some of us live with profound shame, regret, disappointment. It's humiliating for some of us. It's suffocating for some of us. We replay these instances, these moments over and over and over in the back of our memory, and we just won't let ourselves off the hook. We're Christians, basically. We're supposed to be the pros on grace. And you know what justice is? Justice is paying for your sin once. We don't even, let alone grace, we don't even understand justice. We make people repay and repay and repay for the wrongs that they've done. We make ourselves pay for it over and over and over again. In the contemplative, we receive the gift of acceptance, accepting who we are, who we've become, not in spite of our mistakes, because of our mistakes. And it is because of your mistakes that you are beautiful, human. I don't trust somebody who hasn't messed up real big yet. Really. Because people who haven't sort of failed spectacularly and don't know their need for grace, don't give grace. They're dangerous. It's the patches that make us beautiful. It's remembering that the shadow belongs and that our shadow is part of us. And when we learn to make peace with our shadow, we learn to accept ourselves. Which leads to identity. We've been talking a lot about identity for the past 2 days. So there's a lot of folks in a room, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's people in here who have I worked in the adult entertainment industry, or I've prostituted. It's 2014. Some of my friends have done this because they feel empowered and alive by this. Many of my other friends have done this because they feel helpless. We have friends who are single parents and felt like there's nothing else they could do. But if you have had to work, or if you have friends who work, you know that one of the typical things for individuals in the sex trade and the adult entertainment industry is the psychological coping mechanism of differentiation, right? So if you have a friend who works on the streets or whatever, maybe he or she goes by a different name when they're at work, right? If you've ever met folks who have to prostitute when they're out, they usually never let you know what their real name is. And so one of our friends used to be a backup dancer for Nelly. And remember, I don't know what P. Diddy's name is anymore, but I think it was P. Diddy then. She used to backup dance for him when he is on tour. And then after that, she began dancing in clubs. And turns out she danced in all 50 states and all over Europe. But her first day on the job, she walked into a club, and this man asked her to take her, the manager told her to take her clothes off. He sort of looked her up and down, sized her up, and he said, "We're going to call you Crystal." And she was like, "Crystal? It's not my name." But of course, as she began dancing and working in the city, she was glad that she had a different name. Because when she was in the market and some of the guys who went to the bar saw her, they're like, "Yeah, what's up, Crystal?" And she was like, "Oh my God, I'm so glad they don't know me." Had another friend. She was an international deputy finance director for a bank in Jakarta, Indonesia. She had actually worked for the Indonesian embassy in Japan. Little baby girl, her husband had passed away. And so she was looking for a way to provide. She saw in the Jakarta Daily newspaper a full-page advertisement for a major hotel chain here in the States. They were looking for some folks to work in one of their properties in Chicago. And so she applied for the job, received it. She applied for her visa, got it, and bought a ticket. Flew to the States, leaving her daughter with her mother. She arrived in New York late one night. She was met at the airport by some guys who said, "Hey, the last flight to Chicago is already left. Put you on the next one first thing tomorrow morning. Let me take your luggage, your ticket, your passport." And of course, as soon as she got in the car, they put a gun to her ribs. They said, "We're going to call you Candy." She said, "Candy? What's wrong with my name? My name is so beautiful." She still hadn't realized what had happened. And the very next morning, they began prostituting this dynamic, brilliant, capable, educated young woman all up and down New York, Jersey, Connecticut. So these folks try to protect themselves. They try to actually protect their identity by hiding their identity. And sometimes I think we do that. We hide who we really are. Also, as a sort of coping mechanism, a way of self-protection. So anyway, this project of women in Calcutta were together one afternoon, and as the project manager was looking at the blankets and she was holding them up and admiring them, she looked at the women and she said, "You know, every single one of these blankets is a beautiful piece of art. And you know what artists do? They take pride in their work. They sign their name to the things that they create." And so she looked at the woman and she said, "You know what I'd love to do is get really pretty professionally stitched name tags for each of you so that every time you finish a scarf or a blanket or a purse, you can stitch that onto your blanket so that it says Made in India by Supriya, Pooja, Rupa, whatever your name is, I just need you to write it down." And so all these ladies, some of them had been working in the neighborhood with each other for 10, 12, 15 years, sort of looked at each other, sort of got a little weird for a quick minute. Because many of these women had never, ever told one another their real names. So project manager's like, come on, I need you to let me know how this is going to play out. And I think in one of the most beautiful eruptions of restoration I've ever heard in my life, almost every single one of those women in that room wrote down the name their mother gave them when they were a baby girl. Powerful, right? Incredible. The gift of identity coming forward. Coming out. So one of the folks who helped us a lot get that project off the ground was Chris. Do you know who Chris Tomlin is? He's like a singer-songwriter. Okay, so he's like a white guy. does a lot of worship tunes, and he works with these other white guys. I think we sang some of his songs, Matt and Louis Giglio. Anyway, those guys did a ton. They did a ton to help us, to help the women. And so, and they've been good friends for years. And so Chris was coming through town, through Omaha one afternoon. He was on tour, and we grabbed lunch together, and I actually grabbed a blanket. I grabbed one of the blankets, and as we met him for lunch, I gave him a blanket, and I was just like, man, thanks a ton for all that you've done to help the women, help us get this thing going. You've actually invested in freedom, like real freedom. And I told him the name. I told him the name of the women taking back their names, reclaiming their identity. And if you know Chris, he's like super low-key, actually super humble, and just quietly received it and was like, all right, well, kept eating. He's like, hey, man, why don't you come to the show tonight? And I was like, all right. And so I never have gone to like a worship concert or something. I was like, did Air Bunnies. So I show up and it's like in the Mid-America Center, this huge arena. It was totally sold out. And I was like, whoa. And it was like lights and smoke. And it was crazy. It was like, what? So I'm like checking out the scene and I'm like, man, this is nuts. And halfway through the show, you know, these white guys love to do this. They just get the mic stand right in front of them. Sets his guitar down, lights go down, the spotlight's on him, the band walks off the stage, and Chris actually starts to tell this story of this community in Calcutta, and I couldn't believe it. And I'm like, what? And he asks one of the guys in the band to bring out his blanket, and so they run this blanket out there, and he's holding this blanket, and he's talking about these women, and I'm really overwhelmed. I'm actually irrational, so I don't know what to think about my feelings, but like I was getting a little weepy about it, and then he starts to look for the tag on that blanket, the name of the woman who made that blanket, and he says, and this blanket was made by a woman named Mukti. And man, I just started crying. I known this woman for years, and I know that for years, for the majority of her adult life, she has suffered. She has been tormented and assaulted, right? In a little room, a home, smaller than the size of some of y'all's walk-in closets. That she has been called terrible things. But in this place of thousands of people, she was being spoken of with honor, love, and respect. It was incredible. So I go back to, actually on my way home that night, I go back to my office and I call the community center up there in Calcutta. You know, it's late in Omaha, early there. And I was just like, I was still a little bit weepy. And I was like, man, I haven't been drinking, but you got to hear this. And, because folks usually don't get a weepy version of me, and they're like, what? And I was like, yeah, I went to this thing, this guy, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, and this is like the best part. He held up a blanket made by Mukti, and he called her out. And I said, tell her that she has folks on her side here. There's people fighting with her, with you. And the project manager's like, that's great. She's like, that's a great story. She's like, do you know what Mukti means? And like, probably some of y'all speak Hindi or Gujarati or Bengali or Nepali, but Mukti comes, right, from the Sanskrit word for freedom. Can't make up a better story than that, right? Woman who'd been trafficked into prostitution who never let her name come forward, but her name is freedom. It's one of the gifts of the contemplative. When we learn to accept ourselves, we learn to accept others. When we learn to accept ourselves, we reclaim our identity. Like Flynn mentioned yesterday, we don't listen. We reject these lies that we over-identify with. We reject these programs for happiness. We look at the courage of Christ in the face of temptation, and we rest in who we are. For some of us, we need to claim that we are free, that we are loved, beloved, accepted, forgiven. All right, the last sort of interruption or gift of the contemplative that I want to touch on, though, is community, is unity. All right, so from acceptance, we do move to identity. And like Felina said, like, you know, when I was growing up, the whole sort of kitschy little Sunday school gimmick was love God first, self others, and then yourself last. And actually, that's totally a hijacked malformation of how we really understand our biblical mandate to love one another as we love ourselves. if we don't love ourselves, actually we won't be able to love someone else. But we have this sort of busted theology that makes it really hard for us to love ourselves, right? If we believe in a version of original sin, we think that we're born busted, broken, unlovable. But before the doctrine of original sin, there was this doctrine of original righteousness where in the garden, right, God creates humanity, Adam and Eve, and God looks at humanity and says, this is good. This is very good. And I think for some of us, we need to be reminded that we are very good, that we are created beautiful in the image of God, and that we bear that. So when we learn to accept ourselves, when we allow ourselves to claim our true identities, really that's when community can really take root. That's when community forms. So some of the women in the production unit, one of the co-ops there in Calcutta, as they sit on the floor all day stitching these blankets and purses, right, were telling each other their stories of being trafficked. And you can imagine what's going to happen here. So telling their stories of being lied to, of being tricked, of being promised jobs in the city, of being promised all of these things that never materialized, the woman began to hear the same stories. And the woman began to say, I think that same guy told me that same lie. They began to sort of realize that this sort of network of folks that had been trafficking individuals wasn't that large. And in fact, they were using the same people to tell the same, to make the same false promises. And of course, the women were mad. And so they sort of were like, how can we stop these guys? And how can we protect our daughters and our nieces and our family members and the kids and the young women in our own villages, right? And so this is great, man. These ladies sort of organized around themselves this idea of prevention units. And so they wanted to start up these little prevention units in these villages along the India-Bangladesh border that were prone and vulnerable to the traffickers. And of course, these women all knew sort of the profile of the young girl who is vulnerable. And so as they went into these neighborhoods, they began to sort of meet with some of the community leaders and some of the parents, and they began to tell their own stories, and they began to say, look, this is what we want to do. We want to give your daughters a marketable trade. We want to teach them stitching and sewing, right? And then we also want to teach them how to read and write, right? Basic literacy. And so begin these prevention units where in the mornings it was school. In the afternoons, the women worked and made blankets. And, of course, the profits from all these blankets were paid to the women. And then a portion of it was invested back into the organization, really invested back into the possibility of more jobs and freedom. And so I was sitting in one of the prevention units, and it's a completely different feel, right? It's these 14, 15, 16-year-old young women who've never been trafficked, who've never been forced to prostitute or sell sex. And so they're kids, man. They're funny, they're playful, they're silly, some of them a little moody, sassy. I mean, you know it, if you're like 14, 15, 16, and or 26 or 36 or 46. And dear diary, I hate that guy. So one of the girls finished her blanket, and she began to stitch a name tag on the blanket, and she said, made in India by Mukti. And I looked at that girl, and I was like, because I knew her name wasn't Mukti. I was like, what? What are you doing? And the project director looked at me, and he was like, oh, no. He's like, that's cool. She can do that. And I mean, I wasn't scolding her or anything. He's like, because actually all of the girls in the prevention unit sign their names with Mukti's name. They claim the gift of freedom, even though they've never been enslaved. They realize that they stand in a line of legacy on the shoulders of women who've gone before them, who fought for something that they may never appreciate. And I think that's sort of how we want to close this, is that as we nurture the contemplative, we receive the gifts of acceptance, of identity, and unity. And in unity, we claim the gifts of those around us. And Felina has mentioned it quite a few times. Like, one of the things we love and just watching you over the past few days is there's some older folks in here, and there's some super cute little kids in here. And it's great to see you all together, because there are gifts that we need to receive from one another, especially the person in this room that's most different from you. And in the contemplative, we begin to have the eyes to see that, the courage to receive that. So I'm going to close with a story, and Felina is going to pray for us. If you remember the first night, I opened up with a story about my spiritual director, this crusty old Irish Jesuit priest, right? This, I mean, like, when I say super old, I don't mean like super old, but like pushing 80, so older than me. And I don't know if you remember the story, but he was visiting an elementary school, and this little girl realized that he couldn't see, and she blurted it out in his face, "You're blind." And then she said, "You don't know what you look like." And then she said, "You're beautiful," right? Hopefully that's sort of been our journey the past 2.5 days, recognizing our blindness, recognizing that we don't know what we look like, but beginning to receive the truth about ourselves, that we are beautiful, that you are beautiful. So what I didn't tell you was when I signed up for that retreat, I was trying to be like sort of sly. Like I've been meeting for spiritual direction with Father Gillick for probably 8 or 9 years. And because he's unable to see, because he lost his sight when he was 8, when I show up on Creighton University's campus to meet with him once, maybe every 6 weeks, of course he doesn't turn the lights on, but he always sort of knows where to sit me. He has a little couch, 3 little chairs, and I feel like he's always looking at me. And it's pretty intense. Meeting with him for spiritual direction has really saved my life more times than I can recount. But I sort of wanted to be a little anonymous during this retreat, and I knew there was going to be about 40 or 50 people. And so I didn't tell him. I didn't tell him, "Hey, I'm going on the retreat." It was actually going to be a silent retreat for us. And I was just like, man, if I don't have to say anything, if he doesn't know I'm going to be there, I can just sort of like lay low. And so the day before the retreat, the secretary calls me up, and she's like, "Hey, Father Gillick noticed you're on the list." And I was like, "Oh, that's good." And she's like, "Would you mind driving him out to the monastery?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's fine." So that morning, I show up to pick up Father Gillick at the community house, this Jesuit home where he lives with these guys, and help him in the car, and as we get ready to start. I got one of them super duper old school GPS things you stick on a windshield, and like super duper old school, like 1992 called, like what? Anyway, I wasn't using my phone, is what I'm saying. And as I pulled out of the driveway, we call her Samantha. Samantha's like, "Turn left," and Father Gil's like, "Whoa, what's that?" And I was like, "Oh, this is just gonna help us get there." And he's like, "This will be interesting." And I was like, "What does that mean?" And so I'm driving through the city, and you know, we go a couple miles down the street, and Samantha's like, "Turn right." And Father Gil's like, "No, keep going straight." And I'm like, "What?" And it's my spiritual director. I'm like, "Okay, I'm not going to argue with him." So keep going straight. And this happens, like, it's about an hour and a half out the side of the city. And a few times he corrects the directions. And I'm just like, "All right." So we get there. The retreat was amazing. And as we're packing the car up to come back home, you know, we get in the car and Father Gil goes, you won't need that GPS. I'll get us back." And I was like, "Oh yeah, this is great." And look, it's like rural Nebraska. So like basically there's only one way you can go to get to the city, east. But I'm like, all these little country roads and highways. And I'm like, "All right, well, let's see what happens." Start driving away and Father Gil's like, "All right." And the next 2 or 3 minutes, there's going to be an off-ramp here on your left. And it was like really, like within like 90 seconds, there was an off-ramp on my left. And I was like, "All right." He's like, "Take that." I'm like, "All right." So I'm again letting this man drive me home and give me directions. But it got weirder because like 20 minutes into the drive, he's like, "Hey, if you look over to your right, there should be some train tracks." And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "I love driving by these tracks." And he rolls down his window. And a couple minutes later, here comes a train. And this guy's just smiling. And 10 minutes later, he's like, "All right, it's coming up in front of us should be this tractor factory, right?" And I'm like, looking at this tractor factory, and I'm just like, "What is going on with this guy, right?" So like, it's freaking me out. Anyway, this keeps going, even into the city. He's telling me like where to go. And every once in a while, he'll be like, "All right, where are we at right now?" And I'm like, "We're about 50th and Dodge, right?" He's like, "Perfect." And I'm thinking, I want to text Felina because like this blind man is like guiding me home. But I'm like, he'll know I'm texting. So So I get back. I mean, and this guy like really delivers me to his front door. My head is spinning. I get back to our townhouse and I'm like, she's like, "How was the retreat?" I was like, "How was the retreat? This old dude got me here." And I like to close retreats out with that story, because I think that's also one of the gifts of the contemplative. We've been talking a lot about blindness. We've been talking a lot about new ways of seeing and learning to see. We've been talking a little bit about finding our way home. And I think what, Flynn, I want to leave you all with is that if you can give yourself to some of these practices in this posture, God will give you new eyes and new ways of seeing and will surprise you. Because like I said that first night, God is not as hard on you as you are on yourself, and God wants to love you more than you want to be loved. And some of us are trying to find our way home, and we're looking with the wrong eyes, and the ways that we've been doing it aren't working. But I really believe that if we give ourselves to this, God will deliver us exactly where we need to be. And not only will we be safe, and not only will we arrive to the place we need to arrive, but we'll be surprised and delighted, I think, on the journey.